It is Sunday, August 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Just ahead, our correspondent in northern Iraq tells us what local Kurds think of U.S. airstrikes against Islamic State militants as the U.S. campaign reaches its first anniversary. A Midwestern U.S. town marks 1 year since a fatal police shooting that highlighted the issue of police discrimination against minorities. The U.S. Defense Department responds to an alleged hacking attack from Russia. And imagine traveling from one U.S. city to another in a high-speed tube.
Inside the tube, you create a low-pressure environment very similar to an airplane that's on high altitudes.
It's all ahead on International Edition. A U.S.-led campaign of airstrikes against Islamic State militants is getting a major boost from Turkey as that campaign marks its first anniversary. Six American F-16 fighter jets arrived at Turkey's Incirlik Air Base on Sunday, days after Ankara invited the U.S. military, its NATO ally, to use the facility. The U.S.-led air campaign began on August 8, 2014, with strikes on Islamic State group targets in northern Iraq. It expanded the following month to hitting the militants in northern Syria as well. VOA correspondent Sharon Bain is in the northern Iraqi Kurdish city of Erbil, where she's been reporting on the impact of the U.S. military effort. I spoke to Sharon on the phone earlier and asked her what local people think about the airstrikes.
There is overwhelming support here by the Kurdish people of the U.S. airstrikes. And if you remember, this time last year, the Islamic State fighters were only 20 miles or less out of the outskirts of Erbil when the U.S. airstrikes started. And there's generally, from everybody I've spoken to, you know, they recognize that, yes, it was the airstrikes that helped the Peshmerga then push the Islamic State back. So there's overwhelming support. The Peshmerga fighters who have been partners with the U.S. in this, they also say, you know, don't forget, we played a big role. They were the troops on the ground, and they're quite proud of that role.
Do those forces of the Peshmerga think the United States and its allies should do more to help them in any way?
I think there's a general consensus among the security forces here that they would want more weapons and more sort of support. Maybe not necessarily ground forces, but definitely more weapons. What happens is that because the U.S. has to go through Baghdad would then come up and supply the Kurds. There's some political fighting between Baghdad and the Kurdish center up here as to where, how much independence the Kurds should have when it comes to things like weapons and security and so on. So there's been a little bit of frustration that they could get more help. But overall, because the Islamic State has been pushed out largely of the Kurdish areas, the general feeling here is they're feeling much safer. They don't feel that the threat is on their doorstep as they did before. However, there's still quite a bit of fighting up in the Sinjar area where the Yazidis were. In that area, there's been some new fighting, and there are airstrikes there again.
Is there also a feeling among the Kurds there that the fighting that they've done against the Islamic State with the help of U.S. airstrikes is pushing them further toward a goal of independence from Baghdad, or at least greater autonomy from Baghdad?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the feeling up here is that Kurdistan is a de facto separate country. They don't feel that they're part of Iraq, and the bigger the disparate situations are, the larger the gap between what's happening in the rest of Iraq with the Islamic State, with the sectarian fighting, that none of that exists up here. And here it's remarkable. You know, you've got supermarkets, you've got malls, you've got an entirely different lifestyle than you would have in, for example, Baghdad, where you've got bombs going off every day. So the Kurds here actually feel that already they are a de facto, they are their own country. And there's always been a very strong push for independence. I think the fight that the Peshmerga did, they proved, you know, to themselves and to what they feel to Iraq, that they have the ability to defend themselves. And yeah, I think it did contribute to their sense of independence.
And that was VOA correspondent Sharon Bain, in Erbil, northern Iraq. Let's look at what social media are saying about the U.S.-led airstrikes in northern Iraq and northern Syria. International Edition's Gabi Lee is in the studio with me now for the latest. Hi, G, what do you have?
Hi, Michael. Like Sharon just said, the U.S. air offensive in northern Iraq and Syria is widely welcomed by the Kurds. And the U.S. mission to NATO announced the latest decision to strengthen its air campaign to the region Sunday. The mission is on Twitter at USNATO and wrote this tweet about 9 hours ago. Six U.S. Air Force F-16 Fighting Falcons deployed to Incirlik Air Base, Turkey, to support the fight against ISIL. That's been retweeted almost 140 times and marked as a favorite more than 60 times.
Well, ISIL is certainly an enemy of the Kurds, so they might welcome that stepped-up U.S. air campaign. What are other U.S. government accounts saying about that news today?
Well, a couple of them tweeted on this regard, actually. So the Defense Department is at DEPT of Defense, and it confirmed the news 4 hours ago, and here's a tweet. U.S. Air Force deployed six F-16 Fighting Falcons from Aviano to Incirlik in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. The first base is in Italy and the latter is in Turkey. Michael, the White House National Security Council also tweeted about the deployment around the same time as the Defense Department. It's on Twitter at NSC Press. The tweet's content is just about the same, but unlike the other two tweets that I just mentioned, it used hashtag ISIL and hashtag OIR, and that's referring to the Operation Inherent Resolve. And as you know, it's the operation to eliminate the ISIL terrorist group. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and leading contenders from the presidential race have not tweeted about the deployment.
Well, thank you, G, for that update. That was G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Sunday marked another first anniversary, this one here in the Midwestern U.S. city of Ferguson, where a white policeman shot and killed an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, during a street confrontation. The shooting in the suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, drew national and international attention to the problem of police violence in the United States and racial discrimination against African Americans. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon formed a commission last November to study the causes of violent protests against the killing of Brown that erupted in Ferguson 1 year ago. Rasheen Aldridge is a member of the Ferguson Commission. VOA's William Gallo recently spoke with Aldridge and asked him how local people feel about the Brown anniversary.
We know, even though we lost a brother, Michael Brown, this last year, so it's not so much of a, you know, a happy moment, but at the same time, losing Michael Brown has brought a lot of positive change, a lot of positive energy, and a lot of new things, not only to Ferguson, but to the whole St. Louis region. And throughout the year, we have seen positive change happen. So it definitely is a celebration, but it's also letting everyone know that, you know, we're not done yet. This is like just the start. This is just the beginning of more improvements to our community, more improvements to police, improvements to education.
What do you think has been accomplished by this Black Lives Matter movement?
The most beautiful thing, I think, about this whole movement that has happened is the young people that have stepped up, and even including myself, the young people that finally like stepped up and started organizing and started voicing their opinions and started finally saying like that, you know, our lives matter. And not letting the powers that be say that our lives do not matter, and not continuing the status quo to continue to hold us back in a way. So seeing people organize, honestly, has been the most beautiful thing. But there's been, like I say, several other changes. Even the Ferguson Commission, what I'm on, I don't think that would have happened if it wasn't for, you know, young people continuing to take the street.
Now, you are the youngest member of the Ferguson Commission. Can you tell me about what this is working on and what you think it has accomplished locally there?
The Ferguson Commission was appointed to find the solution, but not only in Ferguson, but also in the St. Louis region. At the beginning, I'm not going to lie, I was very hesitant that, you know, that this body was going to be able to do that. You know, most commissions are just commissions, but it's been interesting to see how the individuals on this commission really want to see change, and we don't care about just recommendations, but we care about actually trying to make some type of positive change and trying to act now. I think it's going to be a tool that people can use and actually push for some of the things that we're asking for, like consolidations of not only the municipal courts with some of these police departments, but even from raising the minimum wage to $15. And childhood savings count. So when you're born, you have accounts to hopefully help you go to college. But it's just going to be one more tool that people can use to continue to push for the change that we need, you know, in Ferguson and in the St. Louis area. And hopefully it can be something that other regions can look at and be like, this is what came out of the commission. Hopefully we can adopt some of these recommendations in their legislation or in their community.
Well, that was Rasheen Aldridge, a member of a commission seeking to prevent a recurrence of racial violence in Ferguson, Missouri. Now on to the cyber world. U.S. media say suspected Russian hackers have penetrated the email network of the U.S. Defense Department's Joint Chiefs of Staff. NBC, which first broke the story last week, said it was not clear if the attack was the work of the Russian government or individuals. VOA's cyber correspondent Doug Bernard recently discussed the hacking incident with my colleague Pete Heinlein, who asked him what the hackers may have stolen.
We don't know what was lost. We can speculate. But again, this is the email system and unclassified that was used by the staff of the Joint Chiefs. So probably a lot of, you know, logistical type information, meetings, that kind of thing. But nothing that would reach a classified or certainly a top secret level of communication or information.
So just your normal emails, probably.
Probably. The Defense Department may be more forthcoming about what specifically was targeted or was lost. Some of that may be privileged information. We'll just have to wait and see.
Now, they use a technique called spear phishing.
Right.
Can you talk about spear phishing?
Sure.
I don't know what that is.
Except out in the great briny, I suppose. Well, spear phishing has been around for a very long time. In effect, it's when an individual, a bad guy, let's say, sends somebody else, let's say a good guy, an email that purports to maybe come from their friend or a colleague or an associate. And very often they'll say, you know, hi, Pete, it's been a long time. So-and-so suggested I get in contact with you. I wanted to share this link with you, or here's the document you asked for. What they're trying to do is get you to click on something. And once you do, of course, that's the opening, that's the infection.
Shouldn't the people at the Joint Chiefs of Staff be sophisticated enough to catch those things?
Well, you know, here's the thing. They're human. And really, spear phishing, it's a very simple technique, but we see it used again and again for years, even though we know how to protect ourselves, because we're human. And it's a very easy thing to fall for. The one analyst I spoke with said, well, you know, we keep seeing it because it keeps working.
How can they tell if it's a foreign state? They think it's Russia, but how can they tell?
Well, there are various fingerprints and also sort of techniques that can distinguish where an attack may be from or who may be behind it. Now, I'm using maybe because attribution at 100% certainty is, I don't think it's even possible. But there are digital fingerprints, some very basic and others very complex and sort of refined that researchers have gotten to be pretty good with. And so what they do is many of them are tracking what are known as advanced persistent threats, or APTs. And there's a number of these APT groups in Russia, and generally speaking, the spear phishing attack is not one of them, but generally speaking, the more sophisticated the attack, the more likely that there was a state sponsorship somewhere in there.
And that was VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard speaking with International Edition's Pete Heinlein. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study shows that the world's glaciers are melting faster than ever. An international team of researchers led by the World Glacier Monitoring Service at the University of Zurich have completed a comprehensive analysis of data on global glacial changes for the last 120 years. The study compared observations made from 2001 to 2010 to data gathered in the past by on-site, airborne, and satellite methods. The researchers find that glaciers today are losing between 1/2 to 1 meter of ice thickness each year. That is between 2 and 3 times more than the amount of glacial ice lost on average over the 20th century. The researchers say that for the time span observed, the rate of global glacier melt is unprecedented. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. A U.S.-based company is preparing to start building a futuristic high-speed transport system called Hyperloop. VOA's Maya Pujara has a preview.
The stuff of dreams and science fiction is moving closer to reality. Work on a futuristic steel tube transportation system called Hyperloop begins next year in Quay Valley. The town, scheduled to be built next year, will be run entirely by renewable energy, and it will house the first Hyperloop system, a transportation concept introduced by billionaire entrepreneur Elon Musk. Dirk Allborn, head of Hyperloop Transportation Technologies, has taken the idea and is running with it. He says the system will be safe, cheap, and environmentally friendly.
It's 100% solar powered. So that's basically the invention here.
And best of all, it'll be fast.
We're not going to get up to 760 miles per hour, but we believe that we can actually break the record that are existing right now.
This means that a 4-hour drive from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, for example, could someday take only 30 minutes by Hyperloop. The system involves a series of capsules that hover inside a long tube, so they don't need to travel along tracks. It has been designed to run above or below ground.
Inside the tube, you create a low-pressure environment, very similar to an airplane that's on high altitudes. So now the capsule traveling inside the tube doesn't encounter as much resistance and therefore can travel really fast with very little energy.
Allborn will use the 8-kilometer track in Quay Valley to work out the best way to handle passenger traffic and capsule maintenance, all while securing the estimated $6 to $10 billion needed to build a larger system. If Allborn and his company succeed in making this dream a reality, we may one day see these lightning-fast Hyperloop pods zip through tubes all over the world. Maya Pujara, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for some entertainment news. Some of the top stars of R&B music have agreed to star in a new production of a 1970s Broadway hit musical, The Wiz. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Sean Renee about the revival of the stage adaptation of the classic children's novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
We already know that Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige have both signed on to be a part of what they are calling a live production, a live stage event that's going to air on television here in the States. Queen Latifah signed on very early on to play The Wiz, which I think is going to be very interesting.
That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, first of all, we never thought of the Wiz as being female. And Queen Latifah, as we know, is quite the presence anyway. So I am looking so forward to seeing what she does with that role. Also, Mary J. Blige is going to be playing Eveline, the Wicked Witch of the West.
Get out.
Which I think is probably, I can't imagine anyone else really playing that, because obviously this is a musical. This is based on The Wiz,
right,
which was based on The Wizard of Oz. We all know The Wizard of Oz, but it was in the context of African-American culture. And it started off as a stage play in the mid-70s, and then it became one of my favorite movies of all time in the late 70s. The stage play starring Stephanie Mills, and the movie starring Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Lena Horne. So it was a huge movie and a cultural event. So we just learned that Amber Riley, who is from Glee, she's a very popular young lady out of Glee, has been added to the cast. And what I thought was really interesting is that Uzo Aduba has been added to the cast as well. Now, many people may not know the name, but she plays Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black, which is a hugely successful television show. Many people know her as an actress, but do not realize that she's also played on Broadway, and she was an opera singer. She is a fabulous voice. So this will be the first time that we'll be able to see her and hear her in this form. And she'll be playing Glinda.
Wow.
The Good Witch of the
North.
North, yeah. Yes, of the North, yes.
Well, now, I also understand you were telling me that Don Cheadle's got a new project coming out?
Now, this is a bit different because the whole movie covers a few days in which Miles Davis disappeared into his Manhattan apartment and was reportedly haunted by his ex-wife and his glory days and images. And knowing Miles Davis, this was probably brought on by a substance or two.
A chemical or two, yeah.
But for a few days there, people were wondering where he was. What was he doing? He just went completely missing, and a Rolling Stone reporter was the one that eventually broke into the house and found him. And so Don Cheadle has been working on this project for some time, and he recently got a distribution deal with Sony. And I understand that it's going to be screened at the closing night ceremonies for the New York Film Festival, which is a huge, huge deal. And from what I understand, Don does a fabulous job portraying Miles Davis.
I definitely am looking forward to that. I'm a big fan of his. And if you're a fan of Shauna, you can send her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA_music. You can listen for her in the Soul Lounge. That's at our website, www.voanews.com.
Well, that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The internet is rapidly becoming a major economic driver in the world, and its economic and social benefits are increasingly shifting to developing nations like Indonesia. The United States believes that the internet should be open and accessible to everyone, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs Daniel Sepulveda in a speech in Indonesia. It will take a collective effort to bridge the digital divide, and that's why the United States is determined to work with Indonesia to expand broadband infrastructure and create an economic environment that enables affordable internet connections. Indonesia's impressive economic growth could help it realize the country's potential as a regional leader in the information and communications technology industry. This will not only reinforce existing economic development, but will also give more people invaluable opportunities to contribute to political, economic, and social discourse. Last year's creation of Indonesia's National Broadband Plan was an important first step in the process of bridging the digital divide in this country. The plan's ambitious use of the Universal Service Fund serves as a positive example for the entire ASEAN community, and its aim to connect all public sector facilities like health centers, government offices, and school buildings is of vital importance. As the internet has evolved into the critical resource it is today, governments are grappling with what their role should be and how much power or control they should be able to exercise. The U.S. believes governments must make a choice: to enable the internet's growth or detract from it. The internet has flourished because of the bottom-up, consensus-based process that allows all stakeholders to participate in its growth and governance. This market-driven, multi-stakeholder approach has worked well, and it is the strongest tool to help rapidly emerging economies like Indonesia embrace all the opportunities that the Internet has to offer. The U.S. looks forward to partnering with Indonesia as the country works to reach its ambitious connectivity goals. Together, said Ambassador Sepulveda, we can create an environment in which innovation can flourish and connectivity can enrich more lives every day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.